This is Lecture 3 in the series Wealth, Natural Resources, and the Environment, and the Political Concept of Monopoly.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This morning, I turn to the ecological assault on economic progress. The essential, all-encompassing doctrine of the environmental movement is that the continuation of economic progress is both impossible and dangerous. Insofar as it claims the impossibility of the continuation of economic progress, the movement offers nothing more than a repetition of the claims of conservationism. Indeed, it can be considered as having fully absorbed the conservation movement, with conservationism now standing merely as an aspect of environmentalism. The argument against the possibility of economic progress continuing is, of course, based on the failure to grasp the physical nature of the world and the progressive nature of man. It should not be necessary to dwell further on this aspect of the ecology doctrine, because I have already thoroughly refuted it in my last lecture. I do not intend to spend much time considering the specific claims of danger made by the environmental movement. I think I have dealt with them sufficiently in my pamphlet, which I believe you have all read by now. And Dr. Sanford will further demonstrate the scientific fallacies and outright dishonesty underlying the environmentalist claims in his lecture Tuesday evening. You also have the opportunity of watching the videotapes, The Greenhouse Conspiracy, the 2020 interview with Bruce Ames, and a tape refuting the claims concerning acid rain. That's available in the extracurricular program. There are three separate discussions in my pamphlet which I would like to pull together in order to show as clearly as possible what it is that the environmental movement is attacking. The first of these is my discussion on pages 11 and 12 of the fact that production and economic activity, by their very nature, operate to improve the environment. That is, if one understands by the term environment the external material conditions of human life. Nature provides chemical elements. These elements are never destroyed. They simply reappear in different combinations, in different proportions, in different places. All that man's productive activities fundamentally consist of is the rearrangement of nature-given chemical elements for the purpose of making them stand in a more useful relationship to himself. That is, for the purpose of improving his environment. The entire process of production can be conceived as nothing but the progressive transformation of matter from one state to another in order to render the matter progressively more useful to man. As I put it in my pamphlet, quote, production and economic activity are the means by which man adapts his environment to himself and thereby improves it, unquote. For example, it is an improvement in man's environment when instead of sleeping in rain and mud with a rock in his back, he is able to sleep in a modern home on an innerspring mattress. The second discussion in my pamphlet that I want to stress at this point is the one concerning the accomplishments of industrial civilization, which appears on page 20. Since its birth over 200 years ago in the Industrial Revolution, industrial civilization has been the greatest vehicle of economic progress in all of human history, and has done more than any other human accomplishment to improve the material conditions of human life. That is, to improve man's environment, properly understood. I want to add to that discussion that as the result of industrial civilization, not only do billions more people survive, but in the advanced countries, they do so on a level far exceeding that of kings and emperors in all previous ages. on a level that just a few generations ago would have been regarded as possible only in a world of science fiction. Just think of it. With the turn of a key, the push of a pedal, and the touch of a wheel, we are off driving along highways in wondrous machines at 60 miles an hour. With the flick of a switch, we light a room in the middle of darkness. With the touch of a button, we watch events taking place 10,000 miles away. With the touch of a few other buttons, we talk to other people across town or across the world. We even fly through the air at 600 miles per hour, 40,000 feet up, watching movies and sipping martinis in air-conditioned comfort as we do so. Every time I'm doing that and I look out the window, I think of Gabby Hayes pulling a mule across the desert. In the United States, most people can do all this and have spacious homes or apartments, carpeted and fully furnished, with indoor plumbing, central heating, air conditioning, refrigerators, freezers, and gas or electric stoves, and also personal libraries of hundreds of books, records, and tape recordings. They can have all this as well as long life and good health as the result of working 40 hours a week. All this is thanks to industrial civilization. The achievement of this marvelous state of affairs has been made possible by the use of ever-improved machinery and equipment, which has been the focal point of scientific and technological progress. The use of this ever-improved machinery and equipment is what has enabled us human beings to accomplish ever greater results with the application of less and less muscular exertion. Now, as I point out in a third discussion on pages 13 and 14, inseparably connected with the use of ever-improved machinery and equipment has been the increasing use of man-made power, which is the distinguishing characteristic of industrial civilization and the Industrial Revolution, which marked its beginning. This man-made power and the energy released by its use is an essential basis of all the economic improvements achieved over the last 200 years. It is what enables us to use the improved machines and equipment and is indispensable to our ability to produce them in the first place. As I wrote, energy use, the productivity of labor, and the standard of living are inseparably connected, with the last two entirely dependent on the first. Now, not only does the environmental or ecology movement respond to the marvelous accomplishments of industrial civilization with all the sensibilities what one might expect from a dead log, but in virtually every respect, it represents an attack on industrial civilization, on the values of science, technology, and capitalism on which that civilization rests, and on all of its material fruits, from air conditioners and automobiles to television sets and x-ray machines. The environmental movement is truly, as Ayn Rand so aptly described it, the anti-industrial revolution. The environmental movement is characterized by pathological fear of industrial civilization and of science and technology. It fears the pollution, in quotes, of water and air, as the result of industrial production and the emission of its byproducts. It fears the poisoning of fish, the destruction of rivers and lakes, the pollution of entire oceans. It fears acid rain, the destruction of the ozone layer, the onset of a new ice age, the contrary onset of global warming and the melting of the polar ice caps and rise of sea levels. The environmental movement fears atomic power as a terrifying death ray beyond man's power to use safely. It fears the disposal of atomic wastes, all other toxic wastes, and all non-biodegradable wastes. It fears the use of pesticides and herbicides out of fear of the food chain being poisoned. It fears the use of chemical preservatives and countless other alleged causes of cancer stemming from the, quote, chemicals, unquote, produced by industrial civilization. It fears radiation not only from atomic power plants, but also from color television sets, microwave ovens, toasters, electric blankets, and electric power lines. It fears landfills and the destruction of wetlands. It fears the destruction of animal and vegetable species that are useless or even hostile to man, and demands the preservation of each and every one. It demands the preservation or recreation of everything as it is or was before the arrival of man on the scene. From old growth forests, stretches of prairie, and Arctic and Antarctic wastes, to the reintroduction of wolves and bears into areas from which they had been eliminated. As a result of the influence of the environmental movement, the fears of a growing number of our contemporaries are such that in New York State, they have brought about the impending dismantling of a brand new, fully constructed atomic power plant on Long Island, a plant whose power output is urgently needed to avoid overloads and brownouts and blackouts in the New York City area. The environmentalists seem unaware of such virtually certain consequences as people being trapped in elevators and subways, massive food spoilage, deaths from heat stroke because of lack of air conditioning, and so on, if that plant's power output is not available. All that they seem to be aware of is their imagining of a large-scale radiation leak. As a result of the influence of the environmental movement, a growing number of our contemporaries not only live in fear of being poisoned by alleged toxic wastes all around them, but they also stop eating one thing after another, in terror that it too is poisoned with preservatives, pesticides, chemicals. Increasingly, they view every man-made chemical additive to food as though it were a cause of cancer or other dread disease. More and more, they turn to, quote, natural foods, as though millions of years of blind evolution in the selection of food was to be trusted, but the application of science and human intelligence to the improvement of food was not. The fear of chemicals is such that a major and once proud chemical company has felt obliged to change its slogan from better things for better living through chemistry to simply better things for better living, because the very word chemistry has become controversial and a source of fear. Increasingly, our contemporaries also fear ordinary mechanical devices, from automobiles and washing machines on down to stepladders, and demand absolute guarantees of safety in connection with their use. All of these fears are supposedly in response to the dangers of an industrial society. Yet in virtually no cases has any actual proof of danger ever been offered. Indeed, some of the claims immediately show themselves to be absurd on simple logical grounds. For example, it is a contradiction to fear both a new ice age and global warming from the same causes. Since everything in the physical world is a chemical, it is absurd to fear chemical preservatives. Such a fear means the fear of preservatives as such, and thus fear of the very fact that food does not spoil as rapidly. Not only is there no proof of danger from industrial civilization and science and technology, but all the proof runs entirely the other way. As I have shown, the actual effect of industrial civilization, science, and technology has been to increase life expectancy by 2.5 times since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and radically to improve human health and well-being. The environmentalists simply ignore all this. In their view, it is allegedly outweighed by such things as air pollution and the loss of open prairies. The fear and dread the environmental movement has of industrial civilization leads it to want to destroy industrial civilization. Its essential goal, as I describe it on page 14, is to undo industrial civilization and return the world to the economic dark ages. This is to be accomplished by progressively restricting the production of man-made power, thereby squeezing the life out of industrial civilization. The environmental movement's blindness to the value of industrial civilization is matched only by the blindness of the general public toward the nature of the environmental movement's own actual values. Those values explain the movement's hostility to industrial civilization. They are not known to most people because the environmental movement has succeeded in focusing the public's attention on absolutely trivial, indeed non-existent dangers, and away from the enormous actual danger that it itself represents. As I show in my pamphlet, the actual values of the environmental movement, which explain its claims and its programs, are a profound hatred of man and human reason. This is manifest not only in the kind of vicious statements I quote from Messrs. Graeber and McKibben in the opening pages of my pamphlet, but even more importantly, is logically implied in the doctrine of intrinsic value, which is generally shared by environmentalists. I won't repeat those passages. I ask you to be sure to look at them. They occur early in the pamphlet. The explanation of why acceptance of the alleged intrinsic value of nature necessarily implies hatred of man as the systematic destroyer of the good, and specifically hatred of reason and science as that which allows him to destroy so many rock formations, jungles, and wild beasts. In my pamphlet, I describe environmentalism as the successor to socialism and as the leading manifestation of irrationalism in contemporary culture. I want to devote the time remaining in my lecture today and my lecture on Monday to elaborating on these connections between environmentalism and socialism and irrationalism. Environmentalism is permeated by the philosophy of collectivism. Collectivism is present in its conviction that if individuals are left free, the effect is self-destruction, in the form of such things as global warming and destruction of the ozone layer. Collectivism is present in its conviction that the solution to the problems allegedly caused by free individuals is government action, either to deal with the consequences of the individual's actions or to prohibit the actions in the first place. What I want to show now is how collectivism is present in the responsibilities that environmentalism assigns to individuals, and is also essential to environmentalism's method of argument. To provide the context for establishing these propositions concerning collectivism in the responsibility assigned to individuals and collectivism in the movement's method of argumentation, I want to state that the inherent physical tendency of economic activity to improve the environment, which I described earlier, is powerfully reinforced by the existence of freedom and free exchange. This discussion is necessary to establish some context. Freedom and free exchange create an inherent harmony of the rational self-interests of people. When the actions of individuals are free, and thus are not marred by the initiation of physical force, their effect is necessarily to benefit everyone involved. This is because, under freedom, each individual acts, first of all, to benefit himself. At the same time, he must benefit those whose cooperation is to be secured, or else he will not receive it. In addition, no one standing outside the transaction can be harmed, because any evidence of harm to the person or property of others is grounds to prohibit the action as an act of force and violation of freedom. For example, if I decide to construct a building, I do so because I judge that I serve my own interests by doing so. At the same time, I can find workers and suppliers to help me build it, and a buyer or tenants to use it, only by making it to the self-interest of all of these parties to deal with me. In addition, the construction of my building must not endanger other surrounding buildings or passers-by. If it does, I am guilty of an initiation of physical force against the property or persons of others, and thus grounds exist to stop me. As a result, the inherent tendency of my action is to produce improvement for others as well as myself, and thereby to improve general well-being. The stock in trade of the ecologists, however, is to find cases in which perceptible negative consequences to others appear when the actions of large numbers of individuals are accumulated, and then incredibly to exaggerate the importance of those negatives by techniques of hysteria, in the process obliterating all concern for the rights and responsibilities of individuals. The ecologists conclude by arguing that no individual should be allowed to act without first proving that his action will have no adverse impact, in quotes, on the environment, in quotes. Thus, for example, ecologists consider such phenomena as the clearing of large areas of land for the establishment of farms. Such clearing of land may sometimes have the effect of raising the water level downstream and thereby causing flooding, as allegedly occurred along the Mississippi River as the result of the settlement of the Midwest. Likewise, they consider the fact that the movement of large numbers of people into the same area may result in traffic congestion. And in exactly the same way, they consider the effects of hundreds of millions or billions of people burning fossil fuels, using CFCs, and so on, which actions allegedly result in global warming and ozone depletion. In their treatment of all such cases, the ecologists show themselves to be collectivists. They are prepared to hold individuals responsible for negative effects that are not the responsibility of individuals qua individuals, that is, for negative effects which are not caused by any individual, but which are the result of the combined actions of the members of the group to which the individual belongs. Such negative effects, not being the responsibility of any individual, I believe, should properly be regarded as the equivalent of acts of nature, and individuals should be left free to respond to them in the way most to their advantage. Instead, the ecologists seek to paralyze the individual by harnessing him to the collective, to prohibit him from acting in all cases in which noticeable negative consequences flow from the actions of the collective to which he belongs. And then, of course, instead of allowing the negative effects to be dealt with by the free actions of individuals, the ecologists can see no other solution than that of collective action in the form of government planning. In such cases, the ecologists mistakenly assume that they have the right to prohibit the actions they find displeasing. Actually, however, they do not. The fact that the separate, independent actions of vast numbers of people may result in significant negative consequences to someone by virtue of their cumulative effect is simply not the responsibility of any of the individuals concerned. It should not be a basis for prohibiting his actions. To prohibit the action of an individual in such a case is to hold him responsible for something for which he is simply not responsible. It is exactly the same in principle as punishing him for something he did not do. The harm that results from the cumulative actions of the whole category of individuals, without any of the individuals qua individuals being responsible, should, as I say, be regarded as having the same status as harm caused by acts of nature. That is, such phenomena as floods downstream, possibly resulting from the actions of tens or hundreds of thousands of separately acting individuals, each of whom as an individual causes no perceptible harm to anyone, should be regarded in exactly the same way as floods that result when few or no human beings are present upstream. Exactly the same is true of the similar phenomena or alleged phenomena of global warming, ozone depletion, and acid rain. As the result or alleged result of the actions of vast numbers of individuals, each of whom has no individual responsibility for them, They should be regarded in exactly the same way as one would regard global warming, ozone depletion, or acid rain existing totally apart from modern economic activity. That is, they should be regarded as phenomena of nature for which no individual human being is responsible, and to which individual human beings must be left free to respond. Those who are adversely affected in such cases should not blame anyone, but should simply be left free to take steps to protect themselves by engaging in the appropriate form of economic activity. In the case of downstream flooding, this might consist of building dikes or flood control channels. In the case of traffic congestion, it might consist of building more roads or moving elsewhere. Now, nature, of course, does not produce anything directly comparable to traffic congestion, but it does produce all manner of obstacles in the way of travel, such as forests, rivers, and mountains. Thus, traffic congestion is abstractly comparable to nature's obstacles to travel. In my pamphlet, I explain how individuals could successfully respond to global warming and ozone depletion if the phenomena actually occurred. Others have pointed out that the acidification of lakes could easily be solved simply by adding some lime at a relatively insignificant cost. The all-encompassing appropriate answer to the ecologists in all the cases they bring forward of this kind is simply that under capitalism, man will deal with any negative forces of nature resulting as byproducts of his own activity in precisely the same successful way that he regularly deals with the primary negative forces of nature. Furthermore, it must never be forgotten that the harm done in these cases of negative collective byproducts is necessarily minuscule in comparison with the good achieved. The ecologists use the technique of weighing the full harm against the action of each individual alone. For example, they argue that an individual farmer should not be allowed to clear his land because if hundreds of thousands do so, flooding may be caused downstream. The fact is, the individual farmer accomplishes a substantial amount of good and no perceptible damage. If one wants to look at the damage caused by all the farmers together, it must be compared with the enormous good accomplished by all the farmers together. The development of the Midwest, for example, obviously represented a far greater gain to virtually everyone than the occasional greater flooding in the New Orleans area, which may have been its result, represented a loss. It represented a gain even to the people who lived in the areas subject to the occasional greater flooding. Yet the logic of the environmental movement, had it been present and guided governmental policy in the 19th century, could well have prohibited the development of the Midwest and required the American people to remain bottled up behind the Appalachian Mountains. One can easily imagine a 19th century campaign of ecological hysteria centering not only on the fear of such allegedly horrifying results as greater flood of higher flood levels along the Mississippi, but also on the pollution of many rivers and lakes and on the disturbance of the habitat of this or that species. The impending near extermination of the buffalo would probably have been considered sufficient by itself to stop the settlement of the Midwest if the environmental movement had existed at the time. Well, today we have a very analogous phenomena in the hysteria against the clearing of the Amazon jungle. Precisely the same principles apply to the cases of global warming, ozone depletion, and acid rain. Each individual who uses an automobile, electricity, and so on, derives immense benefits from doing so and causes absolutely no perceptible harm to anyone. The same is true of the manufacturers of automobiles and may be true even of the very largest individual electric utilities and chemical companies, even in connection with the creation of acid rain. The prohibition or curtailment of such activities for the sake of preventing global warming, ozone depletion, or acid rain is fully comparable to prohibiting or curtailing the development of the Midwest for the sake of preventing floods at New Orleans. It is the attempt to stop production and its immense benefits for the sake of avoiding the relatively minuscule negative effects of the byproducts of production. It is comparable to prohibiting the use of machinery and the achievement of all of its benefits for the sake of such a thing as avoiding short-run technological unemployment. The ecologists also employ the technique of confusing the effects of actions of specific individuals with effects that can be caused only by accumulating the actions of large numbers of individuals to downplay the importance of positive individual contributions. For example, the Sierra Club recently argued against the approval of the proposal to search for oil in northern Alaska on the grounds that if oil were found there, it would represent only a 200-day supply, which is allegedly too little to justify the project, according to the Sierra Club. Presumably, each oil field must be capable of dramatically increasing the entire world's supply, adding at least several years all by itself if it is to be allowed to be developed. The implication of this position is that no one is to be allowed to act unless his action all by itself can have absolutely stupendous positive consequences and is virtually certain to achieve them. Since the world supply of anything is almost always produced by large numbers of producers, each of whom produces a relatively small percentage of the total supply, the adoption of this standard easily serves to prohibit increases in production by practically every private individual or firm. Thus, a major technique of the environmentalists is to confuse the individual with the collective, to hold the individual responsible for the negative effects resulting from the whole category, from the actions of the whole category of producers to which he belongs, and to demand that his positive actions be on a scale great enough dramatically to benefit the whole of society. Indeed, the very notion of an environmental crisis, I believe, would not have been possible in the absence of a prevailing mentality of collectivism. In the absence of such mentality, human productive activity would have gone on just as smoothly and successfully as before, with individuals happily and legitimately unconcerned with the effects resulting from the actions of the collective of which they are members, and easily dealing with such effects as and when they arose. The influence of environmentalism has been promoted in the science of economics by the collectivist doctrine known as the theory of external costs and benefits, or sometimes simply the theory of externalities. Professor Williams touched on this yesterday or the day before. Economists realized early that the pattern of spending adopted by consumers determines the pattern of spending adopted by businessmen, whose products must sooner or later serve to satisfy consumers. They saw, for example, that if consumers spent more money for shirts and less for shoes, businessmen would be impelled to spend more money in producing shirts and less in producing shoes. The economists recognized in this the operation of a profoundly benevolent principle, enabling people to obtain what they wanted by virtue of the ways in which they spent their money. Now, the supporters of the externalities doctrine are not satisfied with the fact that the spending pattern of consumers determines the spending pattern of businessmen. They add the further arbitrary demand that the individual should be able to lay claim to compensation for all the benefits his action causes to the rest of mankind, and should be liable for all the costs it imposes on the rest of mankind, even though the benefits and costs in question are not subjects of purchase and sale in the normal context of the individuals concerned. From the perspective of the externalities doctrine, it is a flaw of capitalism Whenever an individual's action provides any kind of benefits to others for which he is not compensated, or imposes any kind of costs on others for which he does not compensate them, it calls upon the government to enter the scene and set matters right by deciding who owes what to whom, and then effecting the necessary redistribution of wealth and income. The alleged environmental damage caused by economic progress is regarded as falling under the heading of external costs, and it is urged that those responsible be held liable for damages. For example, it is argued that everyone whose car or factory emits any chemical into the air should be made to pay a share of whatever damages may be caused by the total volume of emissions of that chemical. It is believed by many economists, including some who are usually staunch defenders of capitalism, that many of the demands of the environmental movement could be satisfied in this way within the framework of a capitalist society. They regard the demands of the externalities doctrine as fully consistent with the principles of capitalism, indeed as representing a more perfect implementation of those principles. In their eyes, the demand for compensation for all the benefits one causes is merely the principle of being paid for one's work. The demand for liability for all the costs one imposes on others appears to them as an implication of the principle of accepting responsibility for one's actions. The externalities doctrine is a further confusion respecting the responsibilities of individuals. In addition to imposing responsibility on individuals for results that individuals qua individuals do not cause, the error of the externalities doctrine is that it states matters far too broadly. A moment's reflection will show that one should not be compensated for all the benefits one causes, nor be made liable for all the costs one imposes. One should be compensated only for those benefits one gives to others, which those others freely contract to receive. One should be liable for damages to others only insofar as one's action causes demonstrable physical harm to the persons or property of specific individual others. The broader standard of the externalities doctrine is an invitation to chaos and tyranny, for it opens the door to all kinds of arbitrary claims. According to the logic of the doctrine, beautiful women and the owners of beautiful homes and gardens should demand compensation for the pleasure the appearance of their persons or property brings to others without charge. Even the senders of unsolicited merchandise through the mails should also be able to demand compensation if their merchandise confers any benefit on the recipients. Indeed, on the basis of the externalities doctrine, it is arguable that people are liable for payment for all the benefits that now come to them freely in the form of the work of all the inventors and authors whose discoveries or creations are not eligible for patent or copyright protection, starting with such contributions as fire and the wheel. Whether or not these payments are to be made to the descendants of the inventors or innovators, or to the government, or to some other party, is a separate question. The principle holds that payment must be made for benefits received. Whatever it may hold about the specific claims of the descendants of inventors and innovators, the doctrine implies that every living inventor or innovator should be prepared to meet demands for compensation by those displaced by the competition he inaugurates. For example, the doctrine implies that Henry Ford should have been made to pay for the support of unemployed blacksmiths and horse breeders, as though the latter had a right to go on in their routine, irrespective of Ford's improvements and irrespective of the voluntary choices of the buyers of means of transportation. It is a distortion of sound principles and totally wrong to call for payment for every benefit received or to demand compensation for every cost imposed. It's in the nature of a division of labor capitalist society to bestow enormous benefits for which people do not have to pay. At least 99.9% of everyone's standard of living comes to him as external benefits provided by men of genius, and for which he does not have to pay. It is also in the nature of such a society to impose various costs of a minor and transitional nature in the process of improving the methods of production and raising the general standard of living. The externalities doctrine implicitly represents a two-pronged attack on a capitalist society. Its logic would deprive people of the benefits such a society freely gives them by making them pay the equivalent of those benefits, and by making those who are the source of the benefits bear unnecessary and unjust costs in the process of bringing them about, it would operate to prevent the achievement of the benefits in the first place. Now, before elaborating on the connection between environmentalism and the collapse of socialism, I want to deal with two further matters under the heading of the economic and philosophic significance of environmentalism. While claiming to be concerned about the environmental impact of everyone's actions, the environmental movement is totally unconcerned about the economic impact of its own actions. It demands that before human beings be allowed to act, they first prove an impossibility, namely that their actions will bring no harm to any species, indeed any geologic rock formation anywhere on Earth for an indeterminately long period of time. It itself, however, is to be free to act without any concern whatever for the consequences of its actions on the lives and well-being of human beings. The environmental movement does not care to know that the rise in the price of oil and all other increases in the cost of living that it has brought about necessarily have a negative impact on human health as well as on happiness, and have actually cut short an undetermined number of human lives. These results occur because, as a consequence of having to meet higher costs of living, there are always at least some people who are put in the position of having to do without, or at least postpone, such things as medical checkups and necessary repairs on their automobiles, home heaters, or wiring systems, and who, because of this, suffer injury or even death from illnesses or accidents that might otherwise have been avoided. This kind of result is the effect of all legislation which increases costs. Such legislation always has negative economic consequences which are not immediately obvious, for it embraces the consequences of millions of people having to respond to some degree of straightening of their financial circumstances and corresponding decline in their standard of living. And in fact, there can even be cumulative negative economic effects which are a little too complex to go into in this lecture. Now, in my pamphlet, I said that the real problem of the industrialized world is philosophical corruption rather than environmental pollution. Allow me to give a concrete example of the corruption of justice, of moral depravity in the United States judicial system. I offer the following excerpt from a news story which appeared in the New York Times of May 26, 1990. I believe that the actions described in this news story rival in absurdity and far exceed in viciousness those described in the ancient report that the Roman Emperor Caligula had made his horse a member of the Roman Senate. Quote, "A New York commodities dealer pleaded guilty in federal district court today to destroying 86 acres of wetlands on his hunting retreat and was ordered to pay a $1 million fine and $1 million as restitution. The dealer, Paul Tudor Jones II, was also banned from hunting migratory wildfowl through 1991. Quote, within the quote, restitution for the birds, unquote, said Judge Frederick Smalkin, who sentenced him. Under the plea bargain, he was fined $1 million, ordered to pay $1 million in restitution to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and ordered to restore the 86 acres, said Jane Barrett, Assistant United States Attorney. Mr. Jones was placed on 18 months probation and barred from developing 2,500 of his 3,272 acre estate. Wetlands are critical because they filter pollutants and provide wildlife habitats," unquote. The meaning of this news story is that the rightful owner of a piece of property has been wantonly deprived of his property, the substance of it, and then outrageously humiliated by a gang of smirking tormentors, indistinguishable in the nature of their behavior from hoodlums robbing an innocent man on the street. For what else does it mean to seize the power to determine the use of someone else's property without his consent and without compensation, and then punish him for daring to use what is in fact absolutely his right to use and no one else's, and in the process, as a calculated act of outrage, make him pay compensation for his use of his own property to birds? The only difference between this and the activities of ordinary street hoodlums is that the hoodlums in this case wear the robe of a United States District Judge and occupy the office of an Assistant United States Attorney. I turn now to the elaboration of the connection between the rise of environmentalism and the fall of socialism. I have said that I believe that to an important extent the hatred of man and distrust of reason displayed by the environmental movement are a psychological projection of many contemporary intellectuals' self-hatred and distrust of their own minds. This self-hatred and self-doubt have been made much more acute as the result of the visible worldwide failure of socialism, and the fact that they, the modern-day intellectuals, as the advocates and apologists of socialism, have been responsible for the destruction it has wrought. As the parties responsible for socialism, for a system which has brought poverty and tyranny to every country upon which it has been imposed, from Soviet Russia and the East European nations to mainland China, Indochina, Ethiopia, Angola, and Cuba, they have certainly been a plague upon the world. And if socialism had in fact represented reason and science, as most of today's intellectuals cannot help but continue to believe, since they have not changed their ideas on anything, there would be grounds to distrust reason and science. For then, reason and science would have been responsible for scores of millions of murders. Of course, it is not reason and science that have been responsible for those murders. What have been responsible are the vicious, irrational ideas and immoral character of the majority of the last several generations of intellectuals. Although it is never spoken of, the undeniable fact is that the hands of several generations of Western intellectuals are covered with blood. Intellectually and morally, they have been accessories, either before the fact or after the fact, to the mass murders committed by the socialist regimes. Socialism, international and national, Marxist and Nazi, with all of its wanton destruction and mass murder, was not an accident visited upon mankind from heaven. It was the product of the leading ideas, moral and economic, of generations of Western intellectuals. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and all of the intellectuals who elaborated and disseminated their theories were responsible for socialism's coming to power in Russia and China and everywhere else that the rule of the communists extended. And all those intellectuals who thereafter refused to know what was going on in those countries, who denied the facts, excused them, or outright lied about them, they bear responsibility for socialism's having remained in power. And wider than these groups, and fundamentally just as responsible, have been all the hordes of intellectuals who consistently evaded the ideas of the major theoretical defenders of capitalism and critics of socialism by ignoring or otherwise refusing to take those ideas seriously. As the result of this evasion, even the very name of Ludwig von Mises, who was the greatest economic defender of capitalism and critic of socialism of all time, is still unknown to the great majority of intellectuals. The great majority of intellectuals never bothered to try to understand the intellectual case for capitalism, namely the economic theories not only of von Mises, but also of the Austrian and British classical economists in general, and the political philosophy of John Locke and the founding fathers of the United States, and more recently, the philosophy of Ayn Rand. For the most part, the intellectuals either ignored the intellectual case for capitalism or found it to be an object of amusement and ridiculed it. Yet such ideas as the law of comparative advantage and the harmony of the rational self-interests of all individuals and groups, which the advocates of capitalism espoused since the time of Adam Smith, would have prevented both the rise of Marxism and of Nazism and the existence of both world wars, if the intellectuals had taken the trouble to understand them rather than to ridicule them. Thus, I believe that it is certainly not without cause that the mainstream of today's intellectuals has lost confidence in reason. The intellectual mainstream has practiced a long-standing policy of massive and willful evasion in refusing to know what it could have known. It has carried evasion to the point of creating for itself an entirely illusory make-believe notion of rationality, which has now come crashing down. The intellectual mainstream has so far removed itself from reality that insofar as it turns to introspective evidence for the reliability of reason, it encounters the fact that on the basis of virtually everything it believes, socialism should work. It believes that on the basis of every principle it knows, socialism is ethically and economically superior to capitalism. And when at last the intellectual mainstream is confronted with inescapable, overwhelming evidence of the failure of socialism, rather than admit that it has been profoundly, devastatingly wrong and needs to now go learn what it should have learned years ago, it decides that it has no other choice than to throw up its hands and take the failure of socialism as the final convincing proof of the failure of reason. And then I believe, in appraising what it perceives as its long-standing adherence to reason in supporting socialism in the face of rising rivers of blood, it comes to the conclusion that reason can be a devastatingly destructive force, and that that those who have adhered to reason are worthy of hatred. Well, they are worthy of hatred, having adhered to their irrationalism, which they call reason. Today's intellectual mainstream, in other words, has very good reason for doubting its mind and hating itself. And thus, it is not surprising to see that just as the failure of Marxian, quote, scientific socialism has become more and more apparent, the ranks of the Greens who hate science and technology have more and more swelled. But while the Greens have come to hate science and technology, they continue to love socialism. Their conception of a post-industrial world is entirely socialistic. Indeed, it should be realized that the environmental movement has the potential for bringing about the achievement of socialism on a global basis, despite all of the enormous setbacks socialism has recently suffered around the world. The establishment of worldwide socialism is implied in efforts to limit global carbon dioxide emissions and other global chemical emissions. The setting of such global limits and their allocation among the various countries of the world imply the existence of a worldwide central planning authority with respect to a wide variety of essential means of production. Such an authority would be necessary to determine which countries were to receive the right to burn how much oil or coal, and to carry on how much of virtually any industrial process that emitted chemicals held to be dangerous global pollutants. A global central planning authority is also implicit in potential international efforts to combat alleged global warming and rising sea levels. Indeed, one of the most prominent theorists of the environmental movement, Barry Commoner, a father of the movement, offers a specific bridge between the doctrines of the socialists and those of the ecologists. The bridge is in the form of an attempted ecological validation of one of the earliest discredited notions of Karl Marx, namely Marx's prediction of the progressive impoverishment of the wage earners under capitalism. Commoner attempts to salvage this notion by arguing that what has prevented Marx's prediction from coming true until now is only that business firms have been subsidized by society at the expense of the environment. In effect, the exploitation of the workers has been mitigated by capitalism's ability, temporarily, to exploit the environment. But now, this process must come to an end, and the allegedly inherent conflict between the capitalists and the workers will emerge in full force. In Commoner's own words, quote, Marx believed that as capital accumulated, the amount of its fixed forms, productive machinery, which is related to what he called the organic composition of capital, would increase. This is the denominator in the profit equation. And Marx believed that as this denominator grew, the rate of profit would fall. There's only a limited amount of profit which you get from exploiting the workers. Now there's more and more capital, the rate of profit is falling. To counteract this trend, he goes on, the capitalists would need to make increasing inroads on the share of production that goes to the workers. The working class would become increasingly impoverished, and the growing conflict between capitalist and worker would lay the grounds for the revolutionary change that is the political outcome of the Marxist analysis. In a curious way, an explanation of why Marx's prediction has failed to materialize, that is, until now, emerges from the improved understanding of economic processes that is one product of the recent concern with the environment. Since no one has to pay for it, there is nothing to keep pollution from happening. And as we now well know, the cost is borne by society as a whole. As I pointed out in the closing circle, a business enterprise that pollutes the environment is thereby being subsidized by society. To this extent, the enterprise, though free, is not wholly private. I pointed out as well that this arrangement leads to a temporary cushioning effect of the debt to nature represented by environmental degradation. There's this cushioning effect on the conflict between entrepreneur and wage earner, which as it now reaches its limits may reveal this conflict in its full force. In this sense, the emergence of a full-blown crisis in the ecosystem can be regarded as well as the signal of an emerging crisis in the economic system, unquote. Here's the idea. Capitalism has created greater total production. The workers and the capitalists have both grown rich, but we've done it at the price of the holy environment, which has limits that we've now reached. We must stop, and now we'll have to, for the workers to get any more, the capitalists have to have less. Well, thus, according to Commoner, Marx will be proved right after all, on the basis of such things as the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and of beer cans on the beach. These will allegedly compel the world to adopt a social system in which much less is produced in total and in which the members of one group can gain only at the expense of the loss of the members of other groups. In that world, apparently, Commoner will feel at home. It will be a world in which men do not join together to subdue nature for their mutual and increasing benefit, but an impoverished, static world in which men must fight one another for scraps of bread, for the alleged sake of appeasing nature. Along these lines, it should be realized that the belief in the need for global limits on carbon dioxide and other chemical emissions, and thus in the need for international allocation of permissible emissions, implies that every country is an international aggressor to the degree that it is economically successful. And thus, of course, that the United States is the world's leading aggressor. For the consequence of its success is held to be either to push the volume of allegedly dangerous emissions beyond the safe global limit, or to impinge upon the ability of other countries to produce whose populations have more urgent needs. Thus, in casting the production of wealth in the light of a danger to mankind by virtue of its alleged effects on the environment, and thereby implying the need for global limits on production, the ecology movement attempts to validate the thoroughly vicious proposition lying at the very core of socialism, that one man's gain is another's loss. I must point out that if the influence of the ecology movement continues to grow, then it is perfectly conceivable that in years to come, the very intention of a country to increase its production could serve as a cause of war, perhaps precipitating the dispatch of a United Nations security force to stop it. Even the mere advocacy of economic freedom within the borders of a country would logically, from the depraved perspective of the ecology movement, be regarded as a threat to mankind. It is therefore essential that the United States absolutely refuse to sanction in any way any form of international limitations on pollution, in quotes, that is, on production. Another noteworthy illustration of the profoundly socialistic sympathies of the Greens is provided by a recent publication of the Sierra Club. This is a collection of essays entitled Call to Action, Handbook for Energy, Peace, and Justice. The book is dedicated to the people of El Salvador and has a preface by Jesse Jackson. It contains articles with such titles as Share the Wealth and Co-ops an Alternative to Business as Usual. Very significantly, and capturing the essence of the book, the editor declares in the foreword that, quote, the political and economic system that destroys the earth is the same that exploits the workers, unquote. The environmental movement, of course, also advocates socialism on a much less grandiose scale than that of worldwide central planning authority. For example, it also advocates socialism in the form of bioregionalism, which represents socialism on the scale of self-sufficient local regions allegedly distinguished by their biological characteristics. As an example of this, see the book by Kirkpatrick, Sale, Dwellers in the Land. This is a book marked by total ignorance of history and of every proposition of economics, which qualifies it to be used as textbooks in graduate schools. Indeed, it is to be expected that the environmental movement will increasingly revert to the advocacy of such utterly naive forms of socialism as bioregionalism, forms which Marx labeled utopian. They are more consistent than is Marxism with the movement's thoroughgoing irrationalism and also with the irrationalist origins of socialism itself. Socialism was originally founded on hatred for reason, science, technology, and the industrial civilization that rests on them. It began as an irrational reaction against the emergence of modern capitalism, as part of a wider romantic reaction against the Enlightenment as a whole. But in the 19th century, the prestige of capitalism's underlying values was beyond challenge. The major contribution of Marx to socialism was to separate himself and his supporters from the then existing main body of the socialist movement, which he labeled utopian, and to wrap the socialist program in the mantle of reason and science. Henceforth, socialism was to be in the vanguard of science, enlightenment, and progress. The unraveling of that effort, which is now taking place across the world, and which is manifest in the collapse of communist regimes, means that socialism should be expected to revert to its irrationalist origins, which is precisely what it is doing in the rise of the environmental movement. Thus, the Green Movement is the old Red Movement, deprived of its pretensions to rationality, and seeking to evade its guilt by turning on reason itself, as though reason were responsible for the failure of socialism and for all the horrors that have been committed as the result of socialism. The Green Movement, in other words, is the Red Movement stripped of the veneer of reason and science and bent on the destruction of reason and science rather than take the trouble to learn what reason and science actually are. The Green Movement is the Red Movement no longer in its boisterous, arrogant youth, but in its demented old age. This, ladies and gentlemen, is where I will stop for now. On Monday, I will complete my elaboration of the connections between socialism and environmentalism and go on to an elaboration of the connections between environmentalism and irrationalism. Thank you very much. Okay, now the floor is open for questions. Mrs. Speiser.
Yes, have you had the opportunity to express these ideas to an other than objectivist audience, and what has been the response?
Oh, you bet I have. thanks to the instigation of some members of this audience, Mr. Garmon and Mr. Trzynski from the University of Chicago, a mini speaking tour was organized for me in April, and I appeared first at the University of Michigan. Chip Joyce is also here, who was there. Mr. Kulkarni, I believe, also comes from the University of Michigan. And so I opened in Ann Arbor, went on to Madison, Wisconsin, to the University of Wisconsin, then down to Chicago, and then a couple of weeks later, I spoke at UC Berkeley, and then most recently at UCLA. Now, what is the response? Well, there's an awful lot of furious anger and hostility. With the exception of Berkeley, everyone was at least civilized. I found they listened, and they have no serious answer of any kind. They do not know what to say when I give that pamphlet, and then I elaborate in the question period. They'll raise questions like, well, is modern civilization sustainable? And I have to explain why there's no problem of resources and one thing and another. And I do think, at least for a time, it's a stopper, and it should make them think. And I'd be delighted to give that talk to as many non-objectivist environmentalist audiences as are willing to hear it and as are willing to pay a reasonable minimum fee of $500 plus expenses. So. Mr. Coates.
I have both a practical and a philosophical problem with your acts of nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. The practical problem is I can't see where you draw the line of numbers of people. In other words, if a small group of people settle on a hillside and they cut down all the trees and then the water floods somebody's homes down below, practically I don't see how, and that sort of thing happens all the time. That's different than if one person did it. And whether the act of nature doctrine is dependent on the number of groups of people. And also, I'm thinking of a philosophical example, which is if somebody poisons somebody, which it's sort of the case, you're talking about some of these examples, with a glass of water, and one person puts in some arsenic and it's not enough to kill me, but a second collaborator comes along and puts it in, neither person individually caused the total effect, but a group action philosophically is the sum of individual actions rather than an act of nature.
Okay, you say you have difficulty on the distinction between the importance of the number of individuals involved, and you have two examples, people chopping down trees and mudslides developing, and someone putting arsenic in a glass of water, which is not lethal in quantity, but then a second person doing it. All right, let me deal with the second point first. You name a collaborator. If you have a concerted plan, and you're going to put in a dose which isn't lethal, and someone else will add to it, well, you have a conspiracy to commit murder. You both do have responsibility. You're acting in concert. Plus, you should not have the right to put any arsenic. You should not have the right to do anything to anyone else's private property against his will. You're doing something. He does not want you to put arsenic in his glass of water. You'd have to do that by some kind of stealth or fraud. Now, the question of the trees on the slope, I would say if we have an individual, he's high up on the hillside, he wants to chop down a particular tree, that has no effect, there should be no basis to stop him. If at some point a perceptible danger arises where you can see, well, I'm going to clear out this whole stand of trees behind my house, and someone down below can say, well, this now represents some perceptible danger, well, then I think he'd have the basis of getting an injunction. But let's, what the case that you would want is, suppose we can't identify any harm of the individuals involved at all, but nevertheless it adds up to a mudslide. Well, then I would say the method of dealing with that arrangement is that you have a contract attached to the properties. If there was, when the land was developed in the first place, the developer could impose a restriction on the buyer who occupies the top of the hillside, and they would recognize that this is a danger, and the buyer would agree to maintain his property in such a way as to avoid the downslide. In the absence of such a pre-existing agreement, in recognition of the impending danger, the party who lives down below could make some payment to protect his interest, and that might thereafter be written into the deed. Mr. Cole had a question, I thought? Okay. This gentleman right over here in the white shirt.
First of all, let me say, I get a lot of fascination out of various forms of nature, and I happen to be a former geologist as well. Mm-hmm. And whereas I agree with virtually everything you've said, I'm trying to tie this back to objectivism. Now, if the essence of objective value is a beneficial relationship to a rational man's love, then as I see, all objects or spectacles or activities that provide him with not only mere food and clothing and shelter, basic shelter, but also with amusement, fascination, relaxation, would be objective values. And as nature in general, and in particular various independent living, that is to say wild species, do provide man with just such amusement, fascination, and relaxation, might not they be called, seen as exhibiting objective value as against the unsubstantiated intrinsic value which you referred to?
Well, you're saying, isn't it the case that such things as the existence of beautiful mountains, various things in nature, including various species, can't one argue that these things, in some sense, are objectively valuable in the way you could make a case, and I imagine Diane Durante will do such a thing, that various sculptors, various works of sculpture and painting are objectively valuable, they should be appreciated. Yes, all kinds of things could be established as objectively valuable, certainly starting with food and clothing. That does not mean that their ownership should be collectivized and that the government should seize control over them. All material means of production should be privately owned, and private owners would take very good care of something like the present area of the Grand Teton National Park or Crater Lake or whichever, precisely because people do want to see beautiful things. They would keep it in the best condition so that the greatest number of people could see it. But there's no basis in the idea of objective values that because I want to look out over a broad, unobstructed plain, that my desire for this objective pleasure means that I can now stop you from going about earning your living. We have to have the pursuit of objective values within the context of individual rights and freedom and private ownership of the means of production. And if we do so, we'll have it. Whoever wants to preserve the various species should be free to go raise money, buy large tracts of land, breed them, keep them, and so on, but not to preserve the wild as such. Let me get someone from this side of the room. Mr. Kagan, is it?
Yes. Recently, the South Coast Air Quality Management District in Los Angeles had a proposal to sell shares to pollute to various industries so that there would be a free market in pollution shares. Mm-hmm. If one industry could create less pollution, they could sell a share to another and so on. Would this be an example of externalities?
Mr. Kagan refers to the proposal or the actual plan of a local air quality management board to arrange a market in pollution rights. And I think there's such a thing even developing in the Chicago Board of Trade. Now, the idea here is that the government, first of all, has the right to limit individuals who individually cannot be shown to cause damage. The government will control the total overall amount of pollution. And if you have been emitting such an amount for so many years, you have the right to continue doing that, but we're going to keep a fixed total. And then we're going to make a market in selling these rights back and forth. Now, I do not believe that the government should have the right to stop people from doing anything where their own particular individual action cannot be shown to be demonstrably harmful to somebody. But it's a lesser evil, I think, to have such a market in pollution rights rather than the government going around telling each specific person, you have to cut back 20%. You see, there are some industrial operations where you could change your production methods relatively inexpensively, and so if they have such a right, they're prepared to sell it. There are other production methods that it's much more expensive to meet the new requirements, so they're better off buying the pollution right. But we should not be overly fascinated with this kind of market. You know, markets have a very a great charm and beauty to them, and it's wonderful to watch how they operate. But it is possible to establish markets in things where markets should not be established, where there is no natural basis for them. And let me give you a clear example. The government could pass a law saying that it is illegal for a couple to have more than two children, or one child, as they've done in China. And then they could, if the Chinese were not such communists, they could say, all right, we're giving to each couple a certificate to have one child, but there are going to be some couples who don't want children, and there are going to be others who want more than one. So why not make a market in these rights to have children? And it would work according to economic principles. The only problem is the government has no damn right to do it. Ms. Tabor.
I wanted to ask you if you have any advice of an effective plan of action that these companies in the country who are really threatened by the environmental movement, what should they do?
What should the particular companies do who are threatened by the environmental movement? I'm sure that there are numerous things that they could do, but one thought comes to the forefront of my consciousness, which is self-serving. They should buy and distribute my pamphlet. Ten minutes. This gentleman right here, yeah. Could I elaborate on her views on the proper financing of a free of government financing in a free society? I'm sure I could, but I wouldn't. I don't think I could have very much of significance to add. So, if possible, rather take a question more closely concerned with environmentalism. If you don't mind, maybe we could talk privately. This gentleman in the middle right here. Yeah.
In a free society operated on objectivist principles, yeah. Would there be the possibility of non-government, private, class action suits? And if so, would it be possible to have class action suits about externalities? The breeders of Los Angeles sue the motors of Los Angeles.
Our two questions are saying, is it proper to have class action suits? And then you raise a specific question coming under the heading of class action suit. Could the breathers of Los Angeles collectively sue the motorists? Well, A, I think it could be proper to have class action suits if We have individuals, each of whom has suffered an objectively demonstrable harm from a specific party. Let us imagine, take the case of the drug thalidomide, perhaps. Now here is a company selling a product which causes the same kind of injury to a broad number of people. I think it would be reasonable that they might consolidate their actions. They constitute a class, the class of the buyers of thalidomide, and they're claiming that the particular company has done them a demonstrable harm. So that sort of action, I think, would be proper. But I definitely do not think that your example, the breathers of Los Angeles suing the motorists, because no individual person in Los Angeles can point to any individual motorist in Los Angeles who has made things worse for him. Now, it would be different if if your window was 2 feet away from the street and I parked my car under your window with the motor running, and so you in your home were coughing and getting carbon monoxide poisoning, that you would have a right to stop. But if I'm running my car and there is no individual who is in any way perceptibly harmed, and no normal individual perceptibly harmed, there is no basis. If the problem is there are several million people doing what I'm doing and that causes a problem, well, there is a certain problem, but then I think you have to regard it as comparable to the problem of hay fever. Can the citizens of Los Angeles, should they go and sue all of the pollen that's growing around? I don't think that there should be any more basis for suing the motorists. Leave the individuals free. Respond to the disturbance, whether it's conceivable that if you're acutely sensitive, it is a disturbance. It affects different people differently. Some people don't mind it all that much. There are others who are acutely sensitive. And if there is no way of making it better, you may decide, well, this is just not the place for me to be. Now, I do think there are things that could be done which would improve things, but which the environmentalists actively combat, foremost being the development of atomic power. If all power generation in the Los Angeles area were atomic, we wouldn't have pollution from, we wouldn't have the problems from the present utilities. Now, there could be something else that might be done, which I don't know if this is remotely feasible, but evidently a major part of the problem in the Los Angeles basin arises from the surrounding mountains blocking the escape of air. Well, why not consider moving a few cubic miles of mountain out of the way and letting the air escape? That would be a more reasonable solution. Yeah. Anne? All right, the question asks me to comment on the very terrible conditions discovered in Eastern Europe after the overthrow of the communists, really dense air pollution and so on. That sort of thing could be expected to happen because there are no individual rights. Here we are, the state owns all the means of production, and if it has a factory which is belching black smoke right into somebody's window, well, what are the rights of that individual against the government in the government's court system? There's no way to seek relief. In a country with private property rights and a semi-rational court system, if a factory owner were doing the kind of real damage done in Eastern Europe, it couldn't get that to that point because individuals would have means of redress. It would be one private party proceeding against another. But when the state does it, there's nothing to stop them. Mr. Cole?
In the LA pollution.
Two more questions.
If the roads were privately owned,
yeah,
then wouldn't people have an action against that owner because the pollution would come from his property, and would he not then require his motorist to take measures and things would be reduced.
Okay, this is a good question. Suppose we had privately owned highways, and here we are. We have enough cars passing along the highway so that you could say American Highways Company is responsible for such and such amount of problem, and here's the specific party to go after. Well, then you might have a basis, and you might say, okay, this company is responsible for a certain amount of damage, and then that company might say, we require or we'll give a rebate to people who are using cars that don't emit this sort of thing. You'd have a market incentive to control the emissions. You'd have identifiable, responsible private parties. But let me point out, just as an add-on, we can probably identify individual utilities today that you could say, all right, here's Con Ed plant number 6 or whatever, and it's certainly making things less pleasant. But then you'd still have to add the caution, if they've been doing this as a long-established practice, you cannot suddenly turn the tables on them. They've developed a certain right, so you have to be very cautious how you would proceed with that. Now, I think should be a way, if there are lots of people who want to do something to change the condition, if there are 1 million people in Los Angeles who would like less smog, and they're each willing to pay perhaps $100 a year, I don't see why, in principle, there couldn't be some mechanism whereby some private party promotes not an ordinary ballot initiative, but because this couldn't be a secret ballot, you'd want people's names, addresses, and credit card numbers. You have a proposition, I, Joe Smith, agree to contribute $100 a year for the next 2 years for such and such purpose, to do such and such thing, provided 1 million other people agree to the same thing. And if 1 million people make the agreement, then everybody becomes bound, their credit cards are charged, and now you've got $100 million maybe to move part of the mountain out of the way, or maybe to give people money to buy a different kind of automobile engine. But in closing, just let me say that the standard that I go by in politics and economics is the rights and freedom of the individual. Man's life is our basic moral standard, but in economics and politics, I think a narrower specific standard applies, which is the means of realizing man's life is the standard, and that's the rights and freedom of the individual. The standard should not be smog reduction or anything of that kind, and anything that we attempt to do has to be consistent, I believe, with the standard of the rights and freedom of the individual. Thank you very much.